Ever notice how the most fascinating stories are never really about what happened, but why it happened? The cultural undercurrents, the power moves, the moments that shift everything? That's where Claude, an AI thinking partner, comes in. For minds that see a headline and ask, what does this really mean? And who's actually behind this? Claude helps you dig deeper into the questions that won't let you go, connecting dots others might miss. Try Claude for free at claude.ai/morningmeeting. Happy Saturday. It's October 18th, 2025, and you're listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in New York.
And I'm Michael Haney, also in New York.
And we are two of your airmail editors here that are hell-bent and determined to find some good in the world. But first, in our dystopian world this week, Trump announced that he's going to meet Putin in Hungary. Mitch McConnell collapsed on the floor of the Senate. And the Reform UK leader in Wales has pleaded guilty to taking bribes from the Russians. Also, Kevin Federline, the ex-husband of Britney Spears, has written a memoir in which he says what many of us have been thinking all along. Perhaps that conservatorship wasn't entirely misguided after all. He's now calling for a new movement, Save Britney. God save us all. As usual, airmail is the antidote to all of these issues, and we've got a great issue and episode for you today.
Yeah, you know, we all know the White House has decided it wants to change how American universities run themselves. And to do that, the White House is holding back federal funding for many of them. Last week, the Trump administration offered 9 colleges, including Brown, University of Pennsylvania, University of Southern California, and others, a deal that would trade special treatment regarding federal research funds in exchange for signing on to a list of conservative demands, including monitoring employee speech. It's a chaotic, strange moment, and yet, as our colleague Claire Malo asks, why aren't more university presidents pushing back? She'll have the answer. Then, if you are of a certain age, meaning maybe you remember the age of Aquarius, you might recall a store in London with the improbable name Granny Takes a Trip. With customers that range from John Lennon to Lou Reed to Mick Jagger, it put the swing in swinging London, and our colleague, Mark Rozzo, is going to join us with his look back at it. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Why don't we talk about the way that some of our most treasured intellectual institutions have completely capitulated to Trump? That's cheerful news. Clara Malo is the investigations editor at Airmail, here to explain. Welcome, Clara.
Thank you for having me.
So Clara, the nihilist in me thinks that all these universities are out there capitulating to Trump because we have just seen so much of that so far. But there have been some new developments in the current administration's relationship with higher education this week. What's going on?
Yeah, so Trump on October 1st asked 9 schools if they wanted to sign this compact with the administration that basically traded better access to funding grants and other federal research grants in exchange for signing along to like a certain number of maybe like cultural policies, like getting rid of DEI, getting rid of masks, genderless bathrooms, things like that. And so a lot of critics have said that that's obviously a huge impediment to academic freedom and free speech on campus, because they're essentially, it's like a money trade for going along with the administration's values and beliefs.
And which universities were offered this ultimatum?
Yeah, so it's a list of 9 of them. It includes Brown and MIT, which actually have been the first 2 to respond and reject the compact. Other universities are USC, University of Texas Austin, I think, responded and was like, we're interested, maybe. So we'll see there. Vanderbilt, basically it was 9. And then as of, I think yesterday, Trump tweeted on True Social and was like, we're opening it up to everyone, basically. So like 5,000 more universities now have the option, which is kind of interesting because it started off being kind of an elitism thing, you know, that these 9 were going to have the opportunity to have like special treatment. And now some people have been talking about it as like, you know, second tier schools, maybe we'll have like deals with Trump and the Ivies, maybe we'll, you know, reject the compact altogether.
I mean, this seems just like a massive amount of effort. Like, why does Trump care so much about what's going on in higher education? I mean, look, we know the broad strokes of the issues that, you know, he's been dealing with Columbia and Harvard and all of these things, but like every single university in the US, I mean, it seems like such a control play.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of 2 really different factors. One is that Trump seems really motivated by like kind of like petty individual drama. So he's picking on schools where he has prior relationships. And 2 is maybe like bigger than Trump. And it seems like this larger attack on the truth and free speech and these kind of very like American principles.
So Claire, one of the things is, you know, early on, I guess, you know, a couple of years ago, I should say, you had Claudine Gay at Harvard and university presidents who tried to sort of like take a stand or not take a stand. And they got caught in the crosshairs, got pushed out. They were the sort of that first wave. But you ask in your column this week, you know, why aren't more university presidents speaking out and taking a stand? And so tell us, like, where are university presidents right now in this sort of like next chapter of dealing with the Trump administration and what that administration wants out of colleges?
Yeah. So post October 7th and then post Trump's election, the second election, a lot of universities have adopted this kind of, as you say, institutional neutrality, which is a term that comes from the University of Chicago, which has a long history of promoting free speech. And it's basically this idea that the school isn't going to take political or financial stances based on like its ethics, essentially. So like that the school is not going to come in and say like, you know, Hamas is wrong, Israel is wrong, or like, you know, we support like Ukraine, because it's not directly impacting the school. And so they're only going to respond or speak out when there's an issue that's actually threatening the campus. And they think that's a way to make it so students on campus can feel like they can be open about what they actually believe. And it's not going to be pro or against like the actual school's beliefs. However, if you're following the like quote unquote Chicago tradition, there has always been a really key exclusion. And it says that it's not even that the school can get involved or speak up when its mission is directly threatened, but it has the duty to. So a lot of these schools have like adopted these policies of institutional neutrality, but kind of have forgotten this main clause, which if you really are following that kind of policy, you know, this would be a time where you actually have to speak up, because nothing is more threatening to the mission of the university than basically like an authoritarian government saying that like they're going to punish the school for having free speech.
Right. So if I understand you, it's, you know, you should speak up if it's a threat to an existential threat to the university, which is, you would argue, what this is, because the administration's asking you to like sign on the dotted line, or you're not going to get funding, which could be critical to your economic well-being, right?
Right. Basically, not only you should, but if you're really following institutional neutrality, you're actually obligated to.
I mean, Clara, how are the students on campus responding to this proposition?
The funny thing about college campuses is like there's such bubbles. I was in school during Trump's first term in office, and I feel like there's one, all this, like campuses are obviously a place where like protests are centered there and like young people tend to be more liberal, more outspoken. But at the same time, you're almost protected from any kind of like real world problems. Like people on campus, my experience was like my friends didn't read the news. And there was like, honestly, like this weird disconnect.
One of the presidents, you know, campus university presidents is the president of Dartmouth, you know, who seemed to sort of like a few years ago sort of figured out, like at a time when the occupiers were on the front lawns and people were taking over buildings, she sort of took a hard line for an Ivy League school, right?
Yeah, she definitely was the most strict. She had also just started, and she has an interesting background because she was at the University of Chicago. So she has this kind of like staunch free speech academic background. And at the same time, she was president of Barnard. And there, you know, for instance, she signed a letter when the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade. She was one of like maybe a handful of university presidents who spoke up, because she said at the time, you know, that was antithetical to Barnard's mission. But since she's gone to Dartmouth, like she's kind of developed a reputation of being quote unquote like a Trump-friendly president, or that Dartmouth was the Trump-friendly Ivy. And part of that has been how harsh she's been on protests. She would tell you that she just believes in a very strict idea of free speech, that like if you, by being a place you're not supposed to be, by you know, yelling, like are impeding on someone else's free speech. And so what she's trying to do is make sure that doesn't happen. What I found interesting is that a professor at the University of Chicago said to me that, you know, if you think about academic freedom in similar terms to the police versus the military, and you say academic freedom used to be that the school was protecting itself and its students and its teachers from the state and the rich and the church. So basically protecting itself from the outside. And there's been this switch. And now it's basically like the administration is saying we're protecting schools from their own students and from their own faculty. And I feel like you're kind of seeing that at Dartmouth, where she's not really protecting the students. The students feel like they are the threat. There have been some that have spoken out and some teachers who feel like she sees them as the threat to the school rather than, you know, it's the Trump administration hammering down on them.
Claire, have the donors weighed in on this matter at all? Because we know money really talks in these institutions, especially.
I think that if you're a donor, what you care about is protecting the school. You know, if you really love Yale, you just want Yale to continue on. So I think that presidents who have been able to thread this needle of seemingly like keeping a backbone, but not being too outspoken are being praised. And I also think like we have to take a step back and realize that some schools have so much more on the line than others. Like if you're a school with a hospital, for instance, you are going to be way more impacted than if you don't, because all of those research cuts, like I think half of Yale's annual income is from the medical school and hospital. And that's being really hurt. Whereas if you're like a small liberal arts school and you don't have other schools attached, you probably don't rely as heavily on those grants. And so you have more of an ability to be outspoken at this moment without feeling the cost.
Well, Clara, thank you so much. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
If you're a creative who finds inspiration in unexpected connections, who sees a design and immediately wonders about its origins, Claude gets that curiosity. Whether you're developing concepts, researching visual trends, or exploring how ideas move between industries, Claude helps you follow those creative rabbit holes that lead to breakthrough insights. Try Claude for free at claude.ai/morningmeeting and see why the world's best problem solvers choose Claude as their thinking partner. Actually, maybe we need to go back to better times, like the 1960s, which seem almost tranquil in hindsight. Now, there's a great new book out by Paul Gorman called Granny Takes a Trip, and it's all about the store in London that was at the epicenter of cool back then. And our colleague, Mark Rozo, is here to tell us all about grannies and the book and that wild time.
Ah, when things were delicious back in the day. You're so right. Well, I think we should do that. Mark takes us back to London in the 1960s when things were very different and fashion was fun. Mark is an editor at large at Aramel and the author of Everybody Thought We Were Crazy, Dennis Hopper, Brooke Hayward, and 1960s Los Angeles. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Mark, we love your story this week because it takes us back to a period of London that was just entirely too much fun, which is to say the 1960s in Chelsea on the King's Road. What was it like at that time, that neighborhood?
Well, apparently that end of the King's Road in the very aptly named World's End was relatively sleepy, kind of not exactly a hipster part of town just yet.
There was a boutique there called Granny Takes a Trip, which, I mean, could have sold all sorts of things, but it was a clothing shop, right?
That's right. So Granny Takes a Trip was opened by three 20-somethings. There was a woman named Sheila Cohen who loved collecting Victorian clothing. Her boyfriend was a painter called Nigel Weymouth, and he had a friend named John Pierce, who was a young tailor who was maybe about 20. So they're all kind of like, I guess they're all basically early 20s. And they had the idea to open this shop where they could sell some of these discoveries that Sheila was making. And meanwhile, John Pierce could create new and flamboyant designs. So they mixed this kind of crazy, you know, conglomeration of like old Victorian stuff, Edwardian stuff, bandmaster coats, just like shirts with like Byronic frilly cuffs and flapper dresses. And then they were making these kind of futuristic flamboyant shirts and things and dresses and boots even right out of the shop itself. And of course, much like the clothing Granny, the interior was tricked out in this like outlandish kind of campy slash psychedelic way. Like it apparently looked like a New Orleans bordello inside, and it had the requisite Beardsley prints on the walls, and it had, you know, a gramophone and an old Scopitone player. Definitely a place where, you know, you could just slip in there and hang out, and they were playing like deafeningly loud psychedelic music at all times, maybe intended to scare some potential customers away who weren't cool enough to be in there. There's a funny story of Salman Rushdie, who unbelievably, and probably because 488 King's Road was so out of the way, when he was a student at King's College, he found like a bedsit in this building and lived upstairs and went down to try to befriend the owners and just felt like he was just nowhere near cool enough to hang there. He tried to engage in some chit chat with Sheila, who just sort of looked him over and just said, "Conversation's dead, man." You know, while I don't know what the incredible string band was, you know, sort of blaring on the turntable.
Salman Rushdie gets kind of the cold shoulder, but as you detail in your story this week, you know, a year or two later, they're all the owners are sitting around, and in walk two guys speaking with a Liverpool accent. Can you tell us about that, which kind of puts them on the map?
Yeah. Well, the amazing thing is, if they opened in February 66, by the spring of 66, the Beatles were already wearing Granny Takes a Trip shirts and whatnot. And this happened because one day when the three owners were sitting around the shop, business was between slow and non-existent, and they were just smoking a joint one morning, and the door, you know, the bell jingles and they hear these voices come in. And of course, they're Liverpudlian accents, and it was John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And they're saying like, "Oh, wow, this is a really great place." So before you know it, our airmail friend and colleague, Michael Lindsay Hogg, is shooting a promotional video for their song Rain. And the Beatles are all wearing Granny Takes a Trip shirts and that. And a still from that shoot becomes the back cover of the Revolver album, which comes out later in 1966. So there really could not have been better advertising in 1966 than having the Beatles wear your stuff. So soon enough, you know, the Stones were getting into the act, and Granny just blew up. And it seemed like anybody who was anybody was walking through those doors, buying any number of things. It could be, you know, Anita Pallenberg and Brian Jones to John Paul Getty II, to Faye Dunaway, various Warholians. And of course, Granny Takes a Trip always had a huge rock star clientele throughout its history.
I mean, it sort of reminds me of like a brother shop to Biba, right? Like, because Biba was outfitting so many of the women of that age. And it sounds like Granny Takes a Trip was really getting the men covered, no?
Absolutely. Paul Gorman, who is the British cultural historian and curator who put together this lovely book that just came out, tells such a compelling story about retail in London at this time being such a pivot point along this kind of road, as it were, along the way to people figuring out how to dress however damn well they pleased. And in London at that time, it included not only Granny, but Biba, as you mentioned. Dandy Fashions was another, Hung On You, I'm Lord Kitchener's Valet. And they presented clothing in a way that felt like fashion, most of them, to men as well as women, which was kind of a novel thing. And as I say, Gorman is a really compelling storyteller in piecing together the way in which Granny and these other shops kind of revolutionized retail in general in London during that era and changed so many habits of taste and custom and merchandising and just attitudes generally about self-expression and self-presentation and all of that stuff.
I love that. But like all great things, you know, it sort of has its moment. Kind of, you know, as you know, the 60s kind of end at Woodstock and what's Joe Cocker wearing, but, you know, some boots he got there. And then kind of like, you know, the 70s come along, new wave, new romantics, and sort of like the shop kind of goes the way of all things rock and roll, right? I mean, it's just like it comes in trends and it has its moment, right?
Oh, it certainly had its moment, and it was a golden one. And you know, as we were saying, it impacted kind of everything that was to follow. And certainly people aren't walking around wearing crazy William Morris print, you know, jackets every day anymore, or insane boots like they used to, but it did have that impact. And what happened at Granny was that in 1969, the original owners sold their labor of love to this guy, Freddie Hornick, who was a bit of a hustler. So he probably knew how to run the business a little bit better, but it wasn't quite that like soulful experience that it had been. He opened in New York. The former location is now, appropriately enough, a cannabis shop. And he also opened a place in LA on Doheny, very close to the Troubadour, you know, which was such a sort of pivotal landmark kind of music club at the time. But, you know, rock stars throughout the 70s continued to get themselves, you know, gussied up in Granny togs, you know, Elton John being the perfect example of that on his album Caribou. Lou Reed on the cover of Transformers wearing Granny Takes a Trip. And one of the really classic Granny stories that Gorman relates in the book has to do with Keith Moon coming to the LA shop one day in 1974. It happened to be the same day as the Oscars, and he was desperate to find an outfit because he had to attend the Oscars, maybe even had to present. And he proceeded to take many, many, many hours trying on every single item in the shop and then snapping at the clerks in there saying, like, "I won't be rushed. It's the Oscars, you pillock." And I do think that pillock is a word that should be used more in America America, sadly not. Finally, at 11 o'clock, he had chosen his outfit. The Oscars by that time were already over, and he reached into his pocket and produced a half of a Barclay card, a credit card, and attempted to pay with that, which of course, you know, was a total fail. But in true Granny style, they let Keith Moon, the drummer of The Who, walk with the merchandise, who's later photographed wearing a pretty cool outfit, actually.
You know, it's like, it's a good reminder of when fashion was really not just a way to look cool on Instagram, but it was a real means of self-expression and creativity. And, you know, it's a good reminder. We should probably get back to that period.
I think you look great. And I think, you know, let's take our big floppy pimpy hats off for Granny Takes a Trip, who allowed us all to dress in however we wanted to.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. Airmail's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our weekly culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, Airmail Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, well, Michael, it is the weekend. I know you've got something you can recommend to us. Please tell me everything.
You know I do. I got something that's going to make us all happy. Were you ever a fan of John Candy, Ashley?
Are you kidding me? Of course I'm a John Candy fan.
Instrumental in Stripes, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Blues Brothers. Anyway, one of my favorite guys and got his start on the legendary comedy show SCTV in the 70s. Anyway, there's a great new documentary out. It's called I Like Me. It's directed by Colin Hanks, of all people, Tom Hanks' son. And it's got everyone from Bill Murray to Steve Martin to Mel Brooks remembering the impact that John Candy made on not only comedy and film and TV, but also their lives and, you know, his tragic early death that sort of left a mark on all of them. So it's a beautiful movie. It's going to make you happy. You're probably going to end up watching Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as we go into the holidays. And this is a great companion to it. A look at a great life and some great films that he made. It's called I Like Me, and you can catch it on Amazon Prime. And you, my dear?
Okay, well, on a completely different note, in a far more depressing territory, have you seen My Father, the BTK Killer? It's this new documentary on Netflix.
I haven't. I've got John Candy. You've got My Father, the BTK Killer. What do you got?
All right, well, are you familiar? Have you ever heard of the BTK Killer?
Yes, bind, tie, and kill.
Bind, torture, kill, to be precise. I mean, this is a story that's of special interest to me because this guy terrorized the city of Wichita, Kansas in the 1970s, and that's where I grew up. And he oddly enough resurfaced in 2025. I mean, he killed 10 people. He was a complete, as we say at Airmail, attention whore, and was engaging with the media all the way. So his story was quite cinematic and tragic and horrific as well. But he was just like an incredibly enduring figure in Wichita, Kansas lore. And now his daughter, who's named Carrie Rawson, is in her 40s, and she has come out and made a documentary about what it's like to be the daughter of a serial killer. And this guy was so creepy for so many reasons, primarily because he was a family man. He was a scout leader. They called him the dog catcher of Park City. He worked in a tiny little town just north of Wichita, you know, sort of doing municipal stuff, like giving you a fine for, you know, leaving your trash out and those sorts of things. Anyway, it's a really fascinating documentary. It gives you really great insight into this bizarre little Midwestern town, but also the bravery of this woman who, you know, many thought should just stay silent and fade into the background. But, you know, she decided to sort of live her life and reclaim at least part of her story and come out as an advocate, you know, for families who have been traumatized by these events. So anyway, I really recommend it. It's called My Father, the BTK Killer, and it's on Netflix. And then Michael, one last thing. If you haven't already had your Diane Keaton Film Fest, it is time.
We had a mini film fest this weekend, past weekend, Brooke and I. We did two of them.
Oh yeah, what did you see?
Well, we started with Annie Hall, of course, la-di-da. And then we did Something's Gotta Give.
Oh, two classics. I did the First Wives Club too.
Oh, see, Brooke, that's her favorite one. But I said, I'm not, I don't want to do that one right now.
I like everything about that movie except the end sequence where they're all walking down one of the streets in Soho and singing You Don't Own Me. It's just like, it's too cheesy of an ending for an otherwise well-acted film.
I don't know. It's a precursor. That's a scene that I feel like inspired Sex and the City moments.
Yeah, that's a very good parallel. I mean, And I had this realization, and maybe this is just because you and I are of a certain age, but don't you feel like in the 90s, like there was always something fabulous coming out? Like every year there was a great movie that was funny and a classic and endured, you know, like just think about the late 90s and the Diane Keaton oeuvre alone. Whereas now, I mean, we do get good movies, but they're like so auteur driven and like serious, you know, that they're just not as much fun.
I think that's a good point. Everything's like serious. No one wants to have fun.
All the funny stuff is on TV now.
Exactly. Or here on Morning Meeting.
Exactly. All right. Well, on that note, we want to wish you all a fabulous weekend. That's a wrap on today's Morning Meeting brought to you by Claude. If you're someone who can't help but ask, where did this idea really come from? Or what if we trace this influence back further? Try Claude. It's the AI that feeds your curiosity rather than rushing you to conclusions. Try Claude for free at claude.ai/morningmeeting. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. And our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe to Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thank you again for joining us.